You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm Andrew Day.
And I'm Connor Eccles.
Each week, we break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news. And we interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. So, Connor, this week we've got a lot of important topics to get into. We'll be talking about whether America's Syria policy has degenerated into absurdity, America's drone problem, the impact of everyday chemicals on fertility, some Trump foreign policy updates, a possible Saudi-Israeli normalization deal, and how AI is straining the power grid. Then we'll have a more in-depth analytical discussion about how the left should respond to Trump's foreign policy proposals. And after that, we'll have an interview with Russia expert Anatol Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll talk to him about the Russia-Ukraine war and what the U.S. should do to resolve the conflict. And at the end, you and I will kind of let our hair down a bit and reflect on what we learned from Levin, who is always a super insightful and knowledgeable guy. So, Connor, which of our news stories do you want to discuss first?
Yeah, I wanted to start out with an interesting news line. It's got nothing to do with all those UFOs in New Jersey. This week, Congress passed a bill with a provision that would give the incoming Trump administration the authority to ban all drones made by Chinese companies from accessing American communication networks. Now, the push for this ban, which has support from some important Trump allies, like his incoming ambassador to the United Nations, Elise Stefanik, is driven by the theory that the Chinese government might use these drones to surreptitiously gather data about the United States or spy in various ways by forcing these companies to turn over their data. It's still unclear whether anything like that has happened. There haven't been public reports of that, but there are fears, especially as we see increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, that China might make a move like that. Now, the problem is that, by all accounts, these Chinese drone makers are a lot better than their U.S. competitors. Between 70 and 90% of the U.S. market is already held by one single Chinese company, DJI, and DJI drones, you know, these consumer drones are considered to be far and away the leader in that category. One way that this could backfire for the United States if we choose to get rid of Chinese drones was shown this week in an article in the journal Science, in its like news feature section, that explained that a surprising number of researchers use these Chinese drones to do a range of research tasks, from monitoring endangered species to tracking microbes and wildfires and other interesting types of research. One scientist who uses a DJI drone to study coastal seaweed and the carbon stores within it told Science that he simply wouldn't trust currently available American drones to carry his expensive sensors out over the open ocean. So yeah, I thought this story was a very interesting example of the complex blowback that you can deal with as the United States and China have such increasing tensions. But anyway, I'll throw it back to you, Andrew, for the second bite.
Sure. So America's Syria policy has degenerated into absurdity after the downfall of the country's autocratic ruler, Bashar al-Assad, argues Brinka Marchetich of Jacobin magazine. For years, the U.S. sanctioned Syria to punish Assad for crimes against the Syrian people. So after Assad fell a couple weeks ago, many people wondered if the U.S. sanctions would fall along with him. But the signs so far suggest that this isn't going to happen anytime soon. U.S. lawmakers from both parties say that it's too early to lift the sanctions, since the rebel groups who overthrew Assad could likewise violate human rights after they consolidate their rule. Of course, the sanctions did weaken Assad's regime, so arguably they succeeded on that score, but the professed rationale for the sanctions never made much sense, according to Marchetich. A U.S. official said that the point of the policy was to protect the dignity and human rights of Syrians and to punish their dictator, but the sanctions further immiserated the Syrian people, while Assad himself lived in an opulent mansion and collected luxury cars. In The Earthling, we note another oddity in America's Syria policy, in addition to the ones that Marchetich pointed to. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently confirmed that the U.S. government has established diplomatic contact with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the leading rebel group known as HTS. Yet last we checked, the FBI still offers a $10 million reward for information on the whereabouts of the group's leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. And Jolani isn't just the leader of HTS, but the de facto new leader of Syria. And he's been meeting with European diplomats and other delegations as he sets up a new national government. So as we know, apparently these diplomats could score a windfall by placing a quick call to the FBI. And I'll toss it to you, Connor.
Yeah, I'll add on that one that there was a news line this morning that I believe the Undersecretary of State for the Middle East is her title, but Barbara Leaf and her team are in Syria today and potentially will be meeting with Jolani today. So I guess, you know, I don't know if this might be a get rich quick scheme. We'll keep an eye on that. But anyway, so for the next item, I wanted to talk about an interesting story from a U.S. government watchdog that said this week that the power grid in the United States and Canada is becoming increasingly strained and could even face supply shortfalls in the coming decade. And in some areas of the U.S., including like Louisiana and parts of the Midwest, like Michigan, we could see increasing power outages or power restrictions as soon as next year. And the report basically says that there are two broad things to blame for these potential outages in the future, these kind of supply shortfalls. One bucket is the increasing use of electric vehicles, which obviously, you know, require an enormous amount of electricity to function. There are many more of those on the road today. But the other one, and what's gotten the most attention in this story, unsurprisingly, is the rapid kind of explosion of new data centers that are being used to power new AI models and cryptocurrencies as AI companies and other kind of tech firms scale up their operations in a big way. So the basic problem here is that companies like OpenAI and Anthropic and all of these major AI producers require extraordinary amounts of electricity to train and run these models, which use very powerful chips and other things in order to carefully train and calibrate their different aspects. And the problem is that the power grid really isn't prepared to deal with this shift, right? So Silicon Valley has responded by putting money into new nuclear power plants. Microsoft even responded by having part of the Three Mile Island power plant reopened. This isn't the part that had a meltdown, of course. This is another part that had been functioning until fairly recently. And the boss of OpenAI has said that he hopes that maybe nuclear fusion could provide a fix for AI's power problems. But the fundamental issue is that none of these bets are likely to pay off in the near term. And so as one official with this watchdog group told the Financial Times, quote, "We are seeing demand growth like we haven't seen in decades. And what we see is the pace only accelerating," end quote. I'll throw it back to you, Andrew.
A growing body of scientific evidence suggests that chemicals found in plastics packaging, sofa covers, cosmetics, and other everyday items harm male and female reproductive systems, the Wall Street Journal reports. The idea that everyday chemicals are a factor in declining fertility rates was once confined to the fringes in American discourse, but has increasingly garnered sympathetic treatment in the scientific community and mainstream press. The journal writes that the increased scrutiny of chemicals runs parallel to rising skepticism about traditional explanations for various health-related quandaries, perhaps most prominently embodied in Robert F. Kennedy's nomination to run the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Kennedy's most controversial positions have been around vaccines and fluoride, but he has for years contended that man-made chemicals are affecting fertility. That was a quote from the piece. One biologist named Patricia Hunt told the journal, quote, "The power of these chemicals to impact fertility is mind-boggling." She went on to say, "We have all sorts of evidence that indicates, whoa, we're in serious trouble here." Last year, America's total fertility rate fell to the lowest on record. And earlier today, I was looking at a recent article from The Lancet, which ran through some striking facts. Their data set seems to have stopped at around 2021. But the global total fertility rate fell from around 5 children for each female in 1950 to 2.2 children in 2021, which is just above replacement level and still falling. Fertility rates are particularly low in South Korea and Serbia, where the rate is around 1.1, but rates remain high in sub-Saharan Africa at around 4 on average. In 2021, 29% of the world's babies were born in sub-Saharan Africa, and this number is expected to grow to 54% of all babies by 2100. Chad has the highest total fertility rate with 7 babies for each female. And of course, the adverse effects of chemicals aren't the only or even most important factor here. There are sociological changes that are relevant. For example, just the simple fact that women are choosing to start having babies later in life. But as I said, many scientists think that everyday chemicals are indeed one factor that's worth considering. And I'll toss it back to you, Connor.
Very interesting. So I have a few updates on how the incoming Trump administration is planning to approach foreign policy based on new comments that we've seen from Trump this week. So the first came in an interview with Time magazine, in which Trump said that he is against the policy of allowing Ukraine to use U.S. missiles to strike deep within Russia. He said that, quote, "We're just escalating this war and making it worse," end quote. That decision had been changed by the Biden administration last month when, after a couple of years of arguing that they could not, that Ukraine could not use these missiles to attack Russia, they decided to flip on that issue. And that resulted in Vladimir Putin's decision to launch a nuclear capable missile at Ukraine for the first time. Of course, it was not a nuclear missile, but it was a missile that would have been capable of carrying a warhead, considered an escalation of the war, of course. So that is something that Trump may be pulling back on when he does return to office in January. Another news line from the Wall Street Journal is that Trump is seriously considering strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities in order to prevent that country from building a nuclear weapon. Trump has obviously had a complicated relationship with Iran during the past decade or so. He withdrew from the nuclear deal the first time around, and after that, Iran has stockpiled a great deal of enriched uranium, and the International Atomic Energy Agency says that they now have enough to produce several nuclear weapons if they're so inclined. Of course, Iran claims that it does not plan or want to develop nuclear weapons, but the West remains skeptical, and both Israel and the United States may see this as an opportunity to strike against these facilities while Iran is significantly weakened. And then the last line, and an interesting comment, Trump didn't say this publicly, but apparently, according to the Jerusalem Post, he's privately saying that he will oppose any Israeli annexation of any parts of the West Bank. This will come as a significant disappointment to a large set of people on the further right within the Israeli political spectrum who had hoped that Trump would back some annexation of the West Bank in his second term following his first term decision to recognize Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. But anyway, we'll have more to say about Trump, obviously, later on in this episode in our more in-depth discussion. But before that, I'll let Andrew take it away for the last news bite.
Sure. So the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported on Tuesday that Israel and Saudi Arabia had reached a breakthrough in normalization talks. But later that day, both Saudi Arabia and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office denied the report. Normalization talks had been set back by Hamas's atrocities on October 7th and Israel's war in Gaza, but they picked up again after Israel's ceasefire agreement in Lebanon. One sticking point in the talks has been the Saudi insistence on explicit Israeli recognition of a Palestinian state. The Haaretz report had said that Riyadh and Tel Aviv had agreed on a vague commitment to a path towards Palestinian statehood. So that was the breakthrough, but Riyadh denied modifying its demands on Palestine, and it has vowed to protect the interests of Palestinians. The U.S. is mediating the talks, and it would act as a guarantor of any deal. And it has even sweetened the pot for Saudi Arabia. President Joe Biden has offered the Saudi regime an ambitious defense treaty with Washington in exchange for normalizing ties with Israel, and also offered to assist Saudi Arabia in the development of its civilian nuclear energy program. Supporters of this proposed arrangement said it would help counter, or have said it would help counter Iran by bolstering America's alliance structure in the Middle East. Critics have said that it is too one-sided in favor of Saudi Arabia, offering little geopolitical value to the U.S., and that it would reward the reckless behavior of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who waged a pretty brutal war in Yemen and who orchestrated the murder of Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Donald Trump is expected to also push for a mutual defense pact with Saudi Arabia. So, Connor, now it's time to transition to our more in-depth analytical discussion. You wanted to talk this week about a recent piece by Matt Duss of the Center for International Policy. He was writing that piece in The Nation. So since you found this piece and found it interesting, I'll toss it to you to kind of set up Duss's basic argument and give your take on it.
Yeah, I did think this was a really interesting piece, and it's particularly interesting because of Duss's background as a longtime foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. He's a very prominent voice among progressives in foreign policy, and he made the argument in essence that progressives should, just as they think about what Biden has done over the last 4 years and measure what was good, what was bad, all those different things, they should be willing to throw their support behind moves that Trump makes in his second term, even if Trump is the one that makes them. So this is basically an argument against the idea of negative polarization, which is basically the problem that you have, like, the opposing tribe says something and you're opposed to it because they said it, instead of it being anything to do with the merits of the policy. One that I think we're likely to see potentially in a second Trump administration, based on some of the comments that he made this week, for example, is a second effort to make peace with the regime in North Korea. Obviously, Trump came under an enormous amount of scrutiny and received a ton of criticism for trying to do that in his first term. But Duss mentions this and other similar initiatives to potentially end wars as things that, you know, if there is reason for progressives to support them, you know, there's a possibility that he'll go about them in ways that would be difficult for the left to support. But if he does genuinely seek peace in some of these conflicts, peace with Iran or peace with North Korea or even Russia, that the left really needs to be open to that and needs to kind of get away from the idea that, you box him in from the more hawkish perspective and you call him weak on these countries, or you say that he is bowing down to these foreign dictators, or, you know, repeating their talking points. So I found this really interesting. I thought it was, I went a little bit further there than his argument. I kind of carried it forward a little bit, but the idea coming from such a prominent foreign policy kind of influencer, I think, will be an interesting sort of an interesting early tone center for Trump's, you know, second term in office.
Yeah, I might have a criticism or two of the piece maybe we can get into. But first, I'll say something I liked about the piece, and it relates to what you just alluded to. You know, when Duss says that the left shouldn't attack Trump's diplomatic initiatives as weak, I think he's right on the money. I mean, in fact, I think not just the left, but Democrats broadly should take this advice, because the Republican reputation for being strong on foreign policy has proved to be very sticky. You know, it's been hard for the Democrats to dislodge that association from voters' minds. So when the Democrats try to flip the script and say that Trump is being weak, you know, he wants to talk to North Korea and Russia and Iran, so he's weak and feckless and, you know, he's compromising U.S. national security. When the Democrats go that route, there's a danger that they end up reproducing this discourse about foreign policy strength, but without convincing voters that the Democrats are strong. It would be better for them, I think, to try to reframe foreign policy debates more fundamentally, not as a contest between the strong and the weak, but between people who want to spend U.S. taxpayer money at home for health care and education and other things that Democrats care about, versus people who want to spend money, you know, on things that go boom overseas. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think it makes a lot of sense. You really don't see, no matter who has been involved in Democratic administrations, you've consistently seen the public believe that Republicans are the ones that are stronger. Like, even when you had emphatically pro, you know, potential humanitarian intervention people, things like that, Hillary Clinton, that did not change the overall image of the Democratic Party as the one that is more likely to undertake, diplomatic initiatives with enemies, things like that. Which I don't think is something that the Democratic Party should be shying away from in the first place. I think that in some cases that is also popular. And we even saw, you know, in the North Korea example, you know, I guess what's really interesting about that, and this is something that you had mentioned when we were talking about this week, is that, you know, when Obama ran in 2008, part of his argument for foreign policy was that we need to engage with adversaries. He argued for engaging with North Korea. It's a little bit complicated because he wound up, you know, making a deal with them, and then, you know, North Korea allegedly kind of violated that deal quite quickly, and there's a lot of controversy around that. But back in 2008, Democrats were very much willing to support that. But then as soon as Donald Trump pursues a similar initiative, just because it's got that kind of Trump ick, they're unwilling to throw their support behind it. And it's the kind of thing that can really tank a policy in the media, too. You know, it was kind of funny. A quote I came across was that Trump described in his sort of, in a sort of ham-fisted way, the media coverage of his North Korea diplomacy as like almost treasonous, which is funny and very classic Trump. But I mean, I think the point that he was making was that it's really quite difficult to do these types of initiatives when you just don't have support in the public for it. You want to see good polling. You want to see news stories that are either complementing this initiative or looking at it in a way that you think is fair. So I think it is really important. But I'm curious if you want to dig in a little bit to your critiques. I'd be curious to hear more.
Sure. Yeah. And on that Obama debate, you know, that which really took place in the primary in 2008, it was kind of interesting because the debate was about whether we should have preconditions. So basically, whether before we agree to talk to North Korea or countries like it, they should preemptively agree to whatever we say, which kind of defeats the point of diplomacy. And Obama was saying, no, we should actually just, you know, talk to them. He might have even framed that as a kind of strong thing to do. Like, I'm strong enough to go talk to these leaders. But yeah, as far as my criticisms, you know, Dust's piece is largely about kind of rhetorical innovations that he thinks the left should make. But I do think that this kind of argument needs to be more attentive to the kind of structural dynamics that have led both parties to be hawkish in the first place. You know, the main problem as I see it is that most voters don't really pay a lot of attention on foreign policy. So a small group of interested parties are the ones lobbying politicians, and the policies they advocate are often pretty hawkish. You know, I'm thinking of the Israel lobby, the Taiwan lobby, the Cuban lobby, the weapons manufacturers, the think tanks funded by the weapons manufacturers and by foreign countries, and so on. So, you know, I don't want to do that annoying thing that commenters and critics often do, where instead of addressing what someone wrote, they say what the piece that person should have written. But at the same time, there is a deeper issue here than just the rhetoric and political visions that the left is putting forward and that Democrats are putting forward. I think you could even say, kind of in Marxian terms, that the stuff Dust is talking about is arguably kind of epiphenomenal. You know, it's like the shadow cast by big business and special interests. So that would be my main criticism, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's definitely not, you know, it's not a materialist critique. It's not looking at where the money goes and those types of things. But I don't really think, I mean, you know, to your point about it being kind of that type of argument that's tricky, where it's like, oh, I'm going to say that he wasn't addressing this other aspect that I think is important. I think it was really a letter to progressives in a way to say, like, chill, guys, right? To say, take a deep breath. It was in many ways a missive against this sort of Trump derangement syndrome phenomenon that a lot of people on the right say has really captured much of the left, in which we're just sort of, the left is sort of unable to acknowledge if there's any positive aspects this week that I would imagine the left should support, or like a broad progressive movement and maybe even the Democrats should support, which was his really interesting comment in that kind of wide-ranging press conference that the United States and China could work together to solve all of the world's problems. That's a slight paraphrase, but that was the basic thing. And that is the attitude that will potentially allow the United States and China to kind of lead on fighting issues like climate change and dealing with the evolution of artificial intelligence that could happen really rapidly and could have all of these secondary military and societal effects that we're not prepared for. That could help us deal with complex things like you know, dealing with, you know, space junk is an issue that we've talked about. There's a lot of satellites up there, and there's not a lot of great international coordination for ensuring that there are orbits that are usable, right? And that we're able to kind of coordinate these between different countries. So there are these big transnational problems that we really need China's help with. And it matters how we talk about it, right? It matters especially to China how we address this. And if Trump is going forward and tries some sort of initiative, some sort of grand bargain with China, or, you know, a Trump to Beijing kind of moment, then it would, I think, behoove the people on the progressive side and the left who want to see those issues dealt with, who want to see climate change dealt with in particular, and even things like, you know, bioweapons and other transnational problems, it would be important to support those efforts. You know, it would be important to actually throw some backing behind it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's a good point. And, you know, one way that does frames it is that this would be kind of like calling Trump's bluff sometimes. And I like that way of putting it, because it is true that, you know, Trump felt a certain political pressure to be more hawkish on Russia, for example. I mean, our guest last week, James Carden, kind of mentioned that whenever Trump talked about why he sent offensive weapons to Ukraine, for example, he said, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, I'm getting attacked from all sides because of my supposed like connections to Putin and to Russia. And so he felt the need to kind of, you know, go back on some of his promises to have good relations with Russia, and to end up kind of escalating in Ukraine and having more hawkish policies on Russia than people tend to realize. So I agree with Dust that could be, you know, the kind of thing that progressives can do to actually push Trump to follow through on policies that progressives should agree with. And, you know, on this issue of weak, the weak argument that Democrats sometimes use, I think it's especially important when it comes to Trump, you know, for reasons that are maybe unfair that have to do like with gender. Like, Trump models a pretty aggressive style of masculinity. And so during the campaign, when the Kamala Harris's team was trying to kind of depict him as weak and her as strong, I think, you know, even though it's unfair that just the Trump's kind of bravado and machismo made that a really difficult rhetorical trick to pull off. I remember after he came out and said that that we should be willing to take sanctions off of Russia and off of Iran and other countries in order to pursue our geopolitical aims, within a few hours, Kamala Harris's, one of her spokespeople, went on Twitter and was talking about how he's weak and feckless and he doesn't understand the importance of being strong. You know, the Democratic Party platform said similar things about some of Trump's more restrained foreign policy moves in his first administration. And yeah, that just really didn't work, apparently, with the electorate. I think that's maybe one more thing I'll say, like kind of another criticism. I mean, maybe I don't know exactly what Dessa said on Russia-Ukraine, but it seems to me that the most important kind of debate between MAGA Republicans and progressives or Democrats over the last few years has been about Russia-Ukraine. And on that issue, Dust has been pretty supportive of Biden's policy, as far as I understand. I know that he and what's the guy's name, Robert Farley, had a piece in, I think, November saying now is time for like a peace plan with Russia-Ukraine. But it's kind of like, no, now is sort of past time. Like, Ukraine is in like a terrible position. It's going to be really hard for them to kind of come to peace talks given the upper hand that Russia has currently in the war. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Dust was saying sort of, you know, things about the importance of pushing for a settlement even earlier in the war, but he was making the case that progressives should really care about this and should be supporting, you know, Biden's push to get weapons to Ukraine and the whole sort of way of thinking about the conflict. But maybe that's the last thing I'll say about this.
Yeah, certainly. Well, that's a pretty good transition, or a great transition, in fact, to our conversation with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. He works in the Eurasia program there, and we're going to have a really interesting kind of deep dive with him about what exactly Russia-Ukraine negotiations might look like, right? So questions about what will be kind of Russian red lines in these talks, what should be Ukrainian red lines, like where can the U.S. fit into this, and even sort of the order of operations. So if you're curious about, you know, getting beyond the headlines and really focusing in on exactly what it might look like to find peace in Ukraine, especially with this incoming Trump administration, I highly recommend that you stick around for this conversation.
Sweet. Let's go to the interview.
Let's do it.
So, Anatol, we've already introduced you earlier in the episode and described your background. But before we dive into questions, I'll add that our listeners can follow you on X at Levin_Anatol. So your last name, underscore, then your first name. So, Anatol, this week you published a piece in Foreign Policy that currently has the title, Start by Keeping Ukraine Out of Ceasefire Talks. So you're making a point about the optimal sequence for the U.S. of the stages of negotiation. For the benefit of our listeners who haven't read the piece, can you talk a bit about your argument and address why you think the U.S. should talk first with Russia and then involve Ukraine in the negotiations later?
Well, the key point is that there are certain basic issues that, in fact, have to be worked out between the U.S. and Russia and do not actually depend on Kyiv, because it's often said that, you know, Ukraine has the right to apply for NATO membership, but in fact, this is not up to Ukraine. Existing members of NATO have to invite a country to join, and every one of them has a veto. I mean, that actually means that even if the US did invite Ukraine to join, it would probably be vetoed by other countries. Well, certainly by Hungary, very likely by Turkey, possibly in future by France. But of course, the most important player there by far is the United States. So, in fact, that is something that the US and Russia should negotiate on their own. To put it quite bluntly, Ukraine does not have a say in that. Any more than, Mongolia would have if it applied for NATO membership. Then there is the issue of the linked issues of the Russian demand for demilitarization, which the Russians have not specified in detail officially, and the linked issue of what guarantees can be given to Ukraine short of NATO membership as part of a peace settlement. And once again, I mean, that really involves NATO. I mean, of course it involves Europe, but it really depends on the US, because a lot of these European weapons, as you know, we saw with the Storm Shadows, and they depend wholly on US technology and US intelligence. So the question of what weapons Ukraine will be barred from receiving from the West as part of a peace settlement, once again, is something that the US will have to negotiate. And on the other hand, what weapons Ukraine will be able to develop. The Russians, a lot of people are referring to the Austrian State Treaty of 1954 as a model. Now, that, of course, did involve the Austrians agreeing to things, but, you know, the key points were negotiated in advance by, well, the West, the US, above all, and the Soviet Union.
And then... Yeah, that's interesting. So are you picturing like a kind of broader, like an actual formal agreement that would happen between the United States and Russia first? Or would it be maybe like a set of understandings that would help to frame subsequent negotiations between Russia and Ukraine?
A set of understandings. Of course, when it comes to, you can have a formal agreement between the US and Russia on arms supplies and other things. And of course, we would have to see how receptive the Trump administration would be to this. But the Russians, of course, are very interested in wider security arrangements. Now, the Russian demand before the war was for, you know, NATO, or at least Western members of NATO, to pull back all their forces from Eastern Europe, you know, back, basically to go back to the conventional forces in Europe agreement of 1997. Now, that as it stands is unacceptable, but, you know, one could imagine a number of things that could be negotiated. For example, you know, America is now planning to station intermediate range missiles in Germany, as it did, of course, with the Pershing missiles in the 1980s. Well, in 1989, there was an agreement whereby the Pershings were withdrawn again, in return, of course, for Russia withdrawing its intermediate range missiles. One could imagine a deal today in which America would not station those missiles, would promise not to do so, and Russia would, for example, withdraw its Iskander missiles from Kaliningrad. One could imagine a situation in which Russia would agree to limit its forces in Belarus, for example, and the US would promise to limit its forces in Poland. There are lots of detailed things that can be negotiated laterally between Russia and the US. But of course, there are other things, and this is why one needs eventually two streams, which of course Ukraine will have to agree to. And they are, you know, anything that, you know, not involving supplies from the West, but Ukraine itself has to agree to the terms of a ceasefire, demilitarized zones, and of course, this issue of denazification, which once again, the Russians have not specified. You know, the Austrians, as part of the state treaty, had to write into their constitution a ban on Nazi parties and Nazi symbolism. Now, that is why Putin has just said that he will negotiate with Zelensky, but an agreement has to be ratified by the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada. That's going to be very, very difficult, especially when it comes to issues like Russian linguistic rights in Ukraine. But, you know, and this is why, you know, also, but before, you know, before we get anywhere near the rubber, Russian and US diplomats need to have some, I mean, if they're capable of it, some sophisticated and original thinking on this kind of issue. I mean, for example, you know, if it's a question of saving Ukrainian face and not simply seeming to surrender to Russia, one could imagine a situation in which, you know, Ukraine makes guarantees about Russian linguistic rights in Ukraine, and Russia makes absolutely equivalent rights about Ukrainian linguistic rights in Russia, where there are, of course, millions and millions of Ukrainians. You know, and you could have a I don't think that would be any problem for the Russians, because most of the Ukrainians in Russia wouldn't take it up anyway. But, you know, you could have a situation in which Russia says, yes, of course, any, you know, community of Ukrainian speakers in Russia, you know, has the right to establish a state-funded Ukrainian language school and to ask for, you know, local documents in the Ukrainian language. You know, and this is what we have diplomats for, what they ought to be for, to, you know, come up with, you know, original and face-saving ways of doing these things. But these things will have to be agreed long before one goes to the Ukrainian parliament.
So, yeah, you've talked about some issues that could be negotiated or possibly negotiated. In the piece, you make a distinction basically between, you know, what Russia and Ukraine want and what they need or say they need. So what their opening bargaining positions will be and what demands they actually consider non-negotiable. Can you say a bit more about what Ukraine's and Russia's non-negotiable positions likely are, and whether the two countries' positions are close enough for a ceasefire agreement to be feasible?
Well, Ukraine's aren't entirely clear. But I think, you know, we nonetheless, you know, have a fairly good understanding of them. One is no, you know, surrender of territory that is actually held by Ukraine. Now, Putin has demanded this, but that's a non-starter. Ukraine will not withdraw from territory it actually holds in these four provinces that Russia claims to have annexed. So if Russia insists on that, there will be no peace agreement. A second is Ukrainian internal politics. Now, you know, you have hardliners in Russia who say we must push for actual regime change, you know, to get rid of Zelensky. Well, of course, you know, the Ukrainians will not permit that kind of Russian interference in Ukrainian internal politics. That is a non-starter. A third thing is that Ukraine must retain an open path, which is not to say that, you know, that they can manage it or the European Union can manage it, but towards membership of the European Union. You know, if NATO membership is barred, European Union membership must remain open. I think the Ukrainians would never agree for that to be excluded, nor actually have the Russians demanded that as yet. So that's on the Ukrainian side. And the Ukrainians will never agree to, you know, reduce their defensive armed forces. I mean, the furthest I can imagine, well, then again, I mean, in the end, this is a decision for the US, but I can imagine, you know, the Ukrainians not getting long-range missiles and the latest fighter jets, but you're never going to get them to give up, you know, javelins and stingers and, you know, all the things that they need for their self-defense, or limiting their armed forces, unless, you know, Russia were to limit its armed forces in ways that are hardly imaginable, frankly. On the Russian side, the non-negotiables are NATO membership. Everybody I've talked to has said that, you know, Putin has nailed himself so much to the principle of no NATO membership that they cannot compromise on this. Of course, you know, Ukraine could simply go back. You know, people forget that there were two aspects to the Bucharest Agreement of 1992 or whenever it was. One was, yes, that Ukraine would give up its nuclear missiles, but the other was that Ukraine wrote neutrality into its constitution, which they only moved from in 2015. But anyway, NATO membership is non-negotiable. Western troops in Ukraine are non-negotiable. I mean, that is why I am surprised and suspicious that about, you know, Western leaders, European leaders now coming up and saying, oh, you know, we could, as part of a peace deal, we could, you know, if Ukraine doesn't get into NATO, we could send, you know, the French have been banding around the idea of 40,000 European troops in Ukraine. I mean, the Russians see that as equivalent to NATO. They will never agree. And the Russians will not withdraw from any of the territory that they hold in the four provinces that they claim to have annexed. Anything they conquer beyond that, which of course they've hardly done, except a very little bit of Kharkov, that I'm told would be a different matter. Certainly that withdrawal could be negotiated, possibly in return for a demilitarized zone. But those are the three non-negotiable Russian positions. And I mean, what I've been told is that, you know, the Russians can get those, then their other demands can be scaled back. So, you know, denazification can be reduced to something fairly symbolic. Demilitarization can only involve, you know, a bar on long-range missiles, for example. But these are all things that, you know, will have to be negotiated. But, you know, if either side, you know, holds firm on some of their stated demands, then there simply will be no peace because they are, you know, unacceptable to the other side. But, you know, yes, Putin has called for the Ukrainians to withdraw from the whole of these provinces. But on the other hand, the Ukrainian formal position is still that Russia should withdraw from all the territory that it holds in Ukraine. Although, in fact, in recent weeks, Zelensky and Ukrainian politicians have admitted that that is extremely unlikely to happen. So, I mean, clearly there is room for flexibility, but how much room will only emerge through talks.
One thing that you're identifying there is that there's sort of a challenge related to the sort of vibe or the momentum going into these talks that needs to be dealt with, right? Because the Russians, from my perspective at least, seem to be sort of picking up steam a little bit on the battlefield. I imagine that Putin is experiencing a certain amount of pressure from the nationalist right within Ukraine to, like you said, continue and seek complete regime change. So I'm curious, what's your perspective on how desperate Russia really is to enter talks at this point?
Well, I don't think Russia is desperate. There's no sign of desperation in Moscow. But on the other hand, yes, Russia is advancing, but it's advancing very, very slowly. All the talk is that Russia, which it probably will be able to capture Pokrovsk in the Donbass in the next few weeks. But Pokrovsk is not really a city; it's a medium-sized town. But as various people have pointed out, if the Russians continue to advance at this rate, it will take them another year just to capture the whole of the Donbass. And although I don't regard, Western intelligence estimates as wholly reliable, there doesn't seem any doubt that the Russians are also suffering very heavy casualties. Russian financial officials themselves have warned of a really serious threat of inflation this year. And, it's fascinating, and it does show that Putin, recognizes, the limits of Russian public support for the war. This is what the Russian hardliners are telling him all the time. For God's sake, launch mass conscription. Conscript 2 million men. Finish this, which would happen if the Russians did conscript 2 million men. But instead, Putin is relying on volunteers and paying very, very highly by Russian working class standards. In some Russian provinces, they're getting five times the average wage, the volunteers fighting in Ukraine. Well, of course, that puts a pretty severe cap on just how many troops the Russians can use, because obviously you can pay 500,000 troops that much money, but you can't pay 2 or 3 million. Money just isn't there, not without sending, inflation through the roof. So it would seem that Putin is not, in fact, committed to total victory in Ukraine. And of course, he has agreed to talks. And I mean, Russian opinion polls show that a majority of Russians would actually accept peace along existing lines, but not surrender, no withdrawal, and Ukrainian neutrality. But that if they got that, so in other words, there is not a huge wave of public opinion or within the regime saying that, we must march on to Kiev or even to, Odessa or Kharkov. But on the other hand, as I've said, there are positions the Russians regard as non-negotiable. But it will depend also, while these talks go on, the fighting will also go on. And obviously, so much will depend on the military analysis on both sides. If the Ukrainians feel they're close to collapse, then they are they will be more likely to compromise. If the Russians feel, you know, that they're just going to have to go grinding on and on for small gains, then they will be close to compromise. But on the other hand, you know, I've said this many times, as have some others, you know, I mean, the analogy of the First World War is a pretty good one. I mean, the fighting in the Donbass does seem very like the First World War. You know, you're having these huge artillery duels over villages, basically, which when captured are then simply heaps of ruins. But, you know, in the First World War, lasted for 3 or 4 years, and then one side or the other cracked, you know. The Russian army cracked in 17. The Italians cracked at Caporetto. The French and British almost cracked in the spring of 1918. And then, of course, the Germans and Austrians collapsed in the fall of 1918. And so, well, and if either side cracks in this war, it's going to be the Ukrainians. So, you know, there is that risk that, you know, things could, and I'm not saying they will. I mean, it's, you know, by now I'm not making any firm predictions about the Ukraine war. But, you know, there is this obvious possibility, given the odds and, you know, the balance of forces, that the Russians will break through. And then, of course, Russian positions will undoubtedly harden.
Yeah, I want to drill down a bit on the issue of security guarantees, because that seems like a particularly tricky sticking point for these negotiations, especially if Russia, you know, wants caps on Ukraine's military. So one idea that I've talked about in the past that I haven't seen foreign policy analysts put forward or discuss is the possibility that in lieu of joining NATO, Ukraine could instead join the EU, which actually does have a collective defense agreement, even though people don't often talk about it. Some countries, when joining the EU, in order to maintain their neutrality, will kind of de-emphasize or even opt out of the EU's collective defense obligations and benefits. But maybe Ukraine and the EU could do the opposite in this case and kind of emphasize that EU nations would come to Ukraine's defense in the event of future Russian aggression. So can you first talk about whether you think that sounds like a plausible path forward? And what are some other ways we can be imagining, you know, security guarantees?
Well, look, I mean, the first thing is...
This was a free preview of
Non-Zero World.
To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.